Welcome to East Meets West, episode 252. I'm Tom Merritt.
And I'm Roger Chang.
And we missed an episode last week because I was on the road. Actually, I was in the air. Actually, I was in Montreal.
You were traveling.
I was traveling. I was on holiday.
You were on vacation.
I was vacating the premises. Part of me likes to say on holiday because I'm an Anglophile, but part of me likes to say it because it just sounds nicer than vacation.
Why?
I think I've mentioned this before, but vacation just sounds like a medical procedure.
No, doesn't to me.
You're vacating something, like you're vacating your bowels.
So?
Holiday is a holy day, you know, I don't know.
Yeah, well, see, I would save holidays for days that are marked as special, like,
yeah,
you know, be it like a national holiday or something like, you know, Memorial Day or perhaps, you know,
Victoria
a religious
day.
Yes. Or you could have, you know, a Christmas or Easter break or Easter, you know, holiday. Mm-hmm. That makes sense. It sounds like holy. It sounds like it's significant. Vacation just means you're vacating your current occupation.
But
and
that's almost like evacuation. I get what you're saying about holiday. It kind of has the wrong implication, too. Like, I don't know. There just needs to be a better word.
I think you're just trying to be pretentious, Tom.
Well, as I admitted, that's part of it, but that's not all of it.
Part of it.
Yeah. No, I don't even think it's most of it. Part of it is, you know, once you start thinking about it, vacation, it just doesn't sound very fun. It just means vacating.
I don't know what kind of vacations you've been
it's
on.
Very
but
technical.
When I
no,
think
it
of...
doesn't sound very fun. I didn't say taking a vacation was never fun. I'm just saying the word itself, when you start to think about it, just doesn't fit, doesn't apply.
I disagree. I think summer vacation, it's like, whoa, it's summer vacation.
Well, that's
out.
Just because you've associated it. It could be
summer
wobbly bop, and you would have grown up saying it, and wobbly bop would mean fun things to you.
But see, now you're associating vacation with, you know, a medical procedure. Not everyone associates it that way.
So
just
words
you.
Shouldn't matter. It shouldn't matter what the etymology of things is what you're saying. It's whatever you associate. We can call things whatever we want.
I mean, you know... If you look at the root, you know, roots of at a lot of words and stuff, I think, you
well,
know.
Now we're just at an impasse. You're saying words don't matter.
No, I'm saying.
Call things whatever is acceptable.
I think you're just
very
being.
Practical way of looking at it. I understand.
I think you're being obstinate. I think you are in. I think you're imbuing certain, you know, intellectual thoughts into a word that I don't think exist for most people.
Well, I agree that it doesn't exist for most people, but can you not see where I'm going with it when you think about the word vacation? Have you never thought of any other word and said, wow, you know, now that I'm thinking about the root of that word and what it means, it's kind of weird. You've never done that.
I've thought about it before. I looked into it like a couple of years ago. Did not change my mind. Does not bother me. Doesn't suddenly. I don't have an overwhelming sense of wow. This is a very disgusting.
No one said anything about disgusting.
Well, it just has a very not negative, but just a very less than pristine connotation. I don't get that. It's vacation. You're on vacation. You're out. When I'm, you know.
I mean, out. It's like, out is a perfectly good replacement. I'm out.
Yeah.
I'm out next week.
Exactly. That's perfect.
Out doesn't have vacation. Any kind of baggage to it.
I think you grab some, you know, leftover luggage at the
but
at baggage
claim. No, you haven't answered my question though. Have you never done that with a word where you start to think about what it really means or the roots of what it means?
I don't think you've ever done that
with any other word.
Would you just let me get a word in here? I have never done it with a word. I've done it with phrases. And then I, you know, like for example, I don't
somehow say. I don't believe you, but go ahead.
That's, hey, you know what? Your credulity does not matter to me. but I've done it with begs the question. When people say begs the question, I looked it up and
wait,
you know, there's
this. I don't know if the podcast listeners can hear it, but did you just turn on your sonic screwdriver?
Oh, I'm sorry. That was, that's my phone alert. Okay. when I get a text, it says.
Okay. Carry on. So begs the question.
Yeah. So, you know, someone brought it up with me. It's like, I hate it when people use that term. It's like begs the question. Well, begs the question. People use it inappropriately in a way that it's actually you know, not what it means. So, I mean, he kind of drilled in me that the correct term is raises the question. So I don't ever use begs the question anymore. I just say raises the question.
But there's lots of things that don't technically mean the right thing, but that we use in place of that. So
I'm just giving you an example. You asked for an example.
But I'm pointing out that you, therefore, when you started to think about the root, you said, wait, this doesn't really fit. Maybe I shouldn't use that. Even though it's perfectly acceptable, it's just as acceptable as vacation. Most people don't mind if you say that begs the question. They know exactly what you mean. The way most people don't mind if you say you're on vacation. I know exactly what you mean.
Yeah. So, I mean, it goes back. I don't see why you're so.
No. I'm just saying. So, but I'm trying to get you to understand. I'm not trying to get you to change your mind about the word vacation.
I understand.
To understand where I'm coming from. It's the same place you're coming from with begs the question, it sounds.
And I appreciate that. I don't see that. And I, you know, hey, it's.
That's okay. You don't have to see it. I just want you to understand why it bugs me.
I understand why it bugs you,
asking you to stop saying the word vacation.
Well, fine. Then I will take a vacation very shortly.
Anyway, while I was out, I was in Montreal.
And, how was it?
It was fantastic. I really, really liked that city.
Did you go outside, or were you just mainly in the island of?
No, they have such great public transportation that we didn't even rent a car. We just stayed in Montreal and went to several different neighborhoods that you could get to by train. Not just Old Port and Old Montreal, which are the more touristy areas, but also Outremont and the Plateau, several other neighborhoods kind of over in that area surrounding Mont-Royal, which is the sort of central park of Montreal.
The central park. You know, it's interesting. It's like... Would you use another thing to describe something else? It's like their Central Park.
Well, and it works in two ways with Montreal. Like several people who lived in Montreal compared it to Central Park to me. They're like, it's modeled on Central Park in New York. They tried to do the same thing, but at the same time, it is also the park that is in the central part of Montreal. So it literally is a central park. But. Yeah,
I know. I mean, that's the Golden Gate Park was kind of the Twin City rivalry between New York and the City Fathers. Well, we need something like this, so they excavated and they developed the area that is Golden Gate Park now. It used to be all sand dunes,
right?
And it's interesting because if you look at, you don't really appreciate it until you actually look at it from the air, and it's a very interesting because you get all this like. Residential area, then you get this big green space in the middle,
and it's huge. It's
yeah,
it's rather large. Anyway, I didn't spend a lot of time up on Mont-Royal, but it is a small mountain, possibly a very tall hill, depending on where you're from. But it gives you a nice 360 degree view of Montreal from the top. I mean, not all at once, but you can, you know, kind of walk around and see all different parts. There's lots of places. We got to the foot. One day, and there was a big old drum circle going on.
Oh, I hate those. I'm sorry.
I didn't even think of, but apparently it's not just like, I'm like, oh, people doing a drum circle. Apparently it's like a huge deal on Sundays.
No, they do it in Golden Gate Park too. It's annoying.
It comes from miles around.
I think people just come from the adjacent neighborhoods or in the city, and they, I don't know, drum circles annoy me. They're very obnoxious. It's a personal thing, and I'm sure there's some sort of spiritual, artistic merit to it. But really, when I walk by, all I want to do is stick my fingers in my ears.
We didn't really go hang out in the drum circle. What we did in Montreal was eat. They have.
Oh, what'd you get? Cool. Or what did you eat?
Well, the first thing we did is we went to Schwartz's Deli. I believe, was that in the Plateau or is that in Mile End? I can't remember what neighborhood it's technically in. It's on St. Laurent Street, and it is an old Jewish deli that serves Montreal smoked meat sandwiches, which are pretty much like corned beef, but tastier, much tastier. And this place apparently does it the best. And wow, not a huge sandwich. You get a lot of meat compared to the amount of bread you get, but at the same time, it wasn't like a monster sandwich. It was doable. You know, we were actually both very happy to see like, oh, this is a reasonable portion. It's a lot of meat, but it's not a lot of bread. It's not like this you know, oh, it's a foot long sausage or whatever. Like it was all about the taste, and man, it was good. And we also got poutine that first day at La Banquise, which is one of the best places people recommended to go. And poutine is French fries, cheese curds, and gravy. And then they can throw in whatever else you want. You can have hamburger, sausage, or peppers. I got mine with peppers and onions. It was quite tasty.
Nice. Well, you ate your way through the city. Did you bring back any souvenirs, or did you get anything that, like, mementos?
Not really. I'm not a big souvenir guy. We did bring back some maple butter because someone asked us to. They're like, when you're in Canada, get maple butter. But that's not like a thing Montreal is known for. I bought an umbrella when I was there because it was raining a lot. But not a special Montreal umbrella. I guess I should have bought some Montreal Canadiens gear.
I actually don't buy a lot of souvenirs. They take a lot of pictures. It's just a lot lighter to carry back.
I let my wife Eileen take all the pictures. She's crazy for pictures. So and there's so many good sites, so many good museums that we were at. We went to the Notre Dame Basilique, which is the oldest and largest of the Catholic churches, and they got Catholic churches every two steps, it seems like. And it was fairly impressive. Although they have this show that they put on to explain the history, don't do it if you ever go to Montreal, or at least don't bother putting the headphones on if you want to go in and see it. What is cool at the end is the cathedral itself is incredible, and they do this sort of like spotlights and colored lights to show off different aspects of the cathedral, which is quite impressive. But getting up to that point, they have this videotaped presentation with horrible writing and bad acting.
So you're saying it's just kind of a touristy,
But do go in and see the cathedral because it's quite impressive.
How was the weather? The climate?
Rainy. Mostly. About half the week, but not so horrible. You know, it wasn't cold. It was chilly, but it wasn't, you know, like had to stay indoors. So we went out and walked around quite a bit, got around on the trains. It was fine. And then the second half of the week, it was beautiful. It was 70s and sunny and gorgeous. When it was raining, we went to this thing called the Biodome, which is out by the Olympic Park and is an old bicycle racing velodrome from from the 76 Olympics that they have converted into a climate-controlled representation of four different climates. So there's a kind of a tropical forest, a St. Lawrence seaway kind of area, a more boreal forest, and an Arctic area. And they have animals and birds living in the biodome. So there'll be monkeys just hanging out in the trees above you as you're walking down the path. And we saw a sloth, like...
Slothing.
Yeah, it was holding on to the girders at the top of the dome and just kind of trucking along. Tons of birds, tons of penguins, ducks.
Interesting penguins.
Yeah, but you remember that biosphere in Arizona where they had the four different climates and the people were living in it? It's kind of like that, except a tourist attraction instead of people living inside.
So no Pauly Shore?
Not any that I saw, although they may have been sleeping.
They may have been sleeping.
They did have a couple of lynxes, but they were separated from the rest of the biodome.
Aren't they endangered?
Yeah, and they're also dangerous to the ducks and the monkeys. So
they're big enough to kill a dog.
Yeah, they were walled off, like, pacing around. Huh. There's an alligator, too.
Oh, nice.
He was just hanging down in the water down below.
I've always been curious about things like zoos where they take animals out of a... Like, if you take an animal that, you know, his natural habitat is like this hot, you know, dry African savannas. I mean, then you shunt him into like some, you know, snowy part of North America. That's like, that can't be good for the animal. It just seems kind of odd.
I think zoos have improved climate control quite a bit. But now this biodome was kind of a step beyond that, where they said we're actually recreating the climate that they lived in and creating a mini ecosystem, which was pretty cool. And it felt like it. We walked in on a very chilly, rainy day outside. We walked in the tropical forest, and it was hot and humid.
Huh. Nice. That's cool.
And it was cool in the Arctic part.
Was it? Yeah. Did they give you parkas, or did you just...
No, they just advised you to dress in layers when you came.
Dress in layers. It's cold.
It was poor penguins, though. They were remodeling the penguin area, so they had drained the pool that they usually were allowed to jump in and swim, and they were all kind of...
Bored.
Not walled off, but, like, you know, the pool area where the water had been was walled off, so they were just kind of trucking around on dry land with nothing much to do. And they, when we were there, attendants were spraying them to get them wet.
That's kind of sad.
Yeah. But, you know, maintenance has to be done. I guess the pool had been leaking or something. If my French is good, that's what I understood. And that's the other thing about Montreal. Everyone speaks French. It's for real. It's not a game. Almost everybody speaks English, too. But they prefer to speak French.
I can imagine. It's a French province.
Well, it has an interesting history. We went to the History Museum and learned this. I would have said exactly the same thing before this, but I found out that when Quebec was taken over by the English and Montreal was the biggest city in Quebec, a lot of English-speaking people moved in, and Montreal became an English-speaking city for a while. And then in the, I guess it was the late 1800s, if I remember right, a lot of farmers moved in from the countryside to get jobs in Montreal and were speaking French. And that is when the big language clashes began in the early part of the 20th century, where they said, this is Quebec, we speak French, you should speak French in Montreal. And so the tide turned the other way and it became a French-speaking city again. And that led to the whole Quebecois movement and the separatist movement and Canada in general becoming a dual language country. But I wondered about that because, you know, most of the place names are French, all the signs are in French, but then there would be street like McGill Street and people, mm-hmm. but it would be Rue McGill. And I'm like, well, that's obviously English. And that those place names come from the time, that brief period where English-speaking people ran the town.
Very interesting. What else did you learn?
I learned a little bit more French than I knew before. Not a lot.
That's cool. Which airline did you go in?
American Airlines.
You know, I haven't heard such good things about them recently. How was the flight?
The flight in was great. Good service. They had Wi-Fi on both legs of the flight. We flew to Dallas and then Dallas to Montreal, and we loved it. It was awesome. The Wi-Fi worked well. The service was fine. No delays. On the way back, we took a short hop to JFK, and then we're waiting to go JFK to SFO. Their plane... They never explained to us what happened, but they had to change the plane. It was supposed to be a 767-300, which is one of those big international 767.
Wide body. No, it's not a wide body. It's a narrow body, isn't it?
No, 767 is a big plane. It's usually done to go across the Atlantic. It's usually an international flight. Sometimes they go to Japan, I guess. This one was going from New York to SFO, so I'm guessing it was one they're like, oh, we need it over on the other coast. And then they had to change it to a 757.
Ah, that's the narrow body.
Now, 757 is the narrow body, and it has less seats. So all of a sudden, not only is our flight delayed because we're waiting on the 757, but not everybody has a seat anymore.
Oh, lame. So what do they do?
When we first walked up to the gate, there was one woman at the attendant, and she was getting to be a little snippy and saying, look, I don't have any answers. I've got 30 people without seats. You can all get in line if you want, but I'm not going to tell you anything different than what I'm telling you right now. And I don't have a supervisor. So I went on Twitter and I was like, you know, woman overwhelmed at gate 40 at JFK, American Airlines, send help. I don't believe that that is what caused it. But within, I'd say 10 minutes, a supervisor showed up. And then like a supervisor to a supervisor, and another gate agent showed up, and they started just processing and answering people's questions, and, you know, and telling them, look, you know, as soon as we know more, you know, we can figure this out. They got approval to offer overbooking. You know how they say, like, we'll give you a $300 voucher if you take a later flight.
Mm-hmm.
So they, you know, they got a lot of people of the 30 that didn't have seats. They got a lot of people to volunteer. They rebooked a bunch of people, and frankly, they made it happen. They did a good job of taking what at one when I walked up to the gate looked like it was going to be a pretty nasty situation, and they turned it around. And then once we got on the flight was fine. Didn't have Wi-Fi because they don't have Wi-Fi in the 757s, but it worked out. And we got back to SFO only an hour later than we would have according to our itinerary. So not bad considering all of the
hoop.
Yeah, all of the challenges they had in making it work.
Yeah, that's cool. At least it's you know, I had to actually fly in a 737, one of those small, really small regional planes. They usually just fly you between like two major hubs. I had to fly from Chicago O'Hare to Oakland on that thing. Ooh. Oh my God, yeah, it's so cramped.
It's 737 is what we took from Montreal to New York because it's just, you know, it's just a short hop. It's only an hour flight. That's cramped, man. Did they give you anything?
No.
American Airlines?
No, I'm trying to remember who it was. It was for when I was working over at CNET. I'm trying to remember the airline. I can't.
You know, I feel like United is in flux, and I don't really know which way they're going, but they had been getting worse and worse. They were pretty much, from what I could tell, only paying attention to their business class and first class customers. Because whenever, on the very few occasions I flew business class, then United service was awesome. But when I would fly coach, it was the worst airline that I fly regularly. American used to be pretty bad right after they bought TWA. It seemed like they were in disarray. Now they seem to be putting it back together. At least they're trying to. So I wonder, with United merging with Continental, if that will also happen. Because Continental, when I flew Continental for years out of Austin, they had great service. So I don't know if United's going to ruin Continental or Continental will improve United or it'll meet somewhere in the middle. But none of them touch Virgin. Virgin has such great service. They don't fly everywhere, but Virgin.
Yeah, that's the biggest downfall. Well, not downfall, but the biggest problem I have with Virgin is they don't fly everywhere I need it to.
Wait, you can't take them everywhere you want to go. I should be an elite business frequent flyer member on some airline this year with the amount of travel I've done, but I've always been traveling on someone different. I haven't traveled on the same airline every time.
Yeah, I don't know. It seems I'm not really into that anymore. I mean, I understand the benefits, but it's just like, you know, I get the flight that's most convenient.
Yeah.
I try to do that.
Well, if you're flying a lot, I think it's worth it to try to get elite status because I was elite on Continental for a couple of years and it was really nice to be able to like use the lounge, board first, get priority bag checking, you know, free upgrades to first class, all that stuff. It's a really good thing to do. But if you're only flying maybe, you know, less than five times a year, I don't know that it's worth it to try for it because you're probably not going to make it anyway. And then you're stuck flying places that you wouldn't otherwise. But if you're flying 10, 20 times a year, then I don't know. I'm starting to look at it like, well, maybe I should be flying on the same airline all the time. But I'd like to fly in Virgin America all the time. They don't go everywhere I need to go. And they don't have like one of those frequent flyer programs that gives you the, you know, elite status. Which I actually like that they don't do that because it's basically saying everybody is treated like a valuable customer. The problem with the airlines that do the elite status is you only get treated like a valuable customer if you're one of their frequent flyer elites.
It's good to know. Good to know. I don't fly that much anymore.
I didn't for a while. This year, I've been traveling a lot, and I'm gonna be gone again next week because I have to go to my nephew's graduation. He's graduating from high school.
Oh, nice.
Then in June, I'm going to Nerdtacular in Salt Lake City.
Mm-hmm.
Are you going?
I don't think I'll have the available bandwidth to travel during that month.
It's not by the internet. You travel in a plane.
No, I understand.
You don't need bandwidth.
The amount of available, we're doing a lot of stuff at work that right. I need to be around for, unfortunately.
And then after Nerdtacular, I think the week after Nerdtacular, I'm going to Ontario, Canada for Podcasters Across Borders.
Oh, wow. You're just a regular jet setter.
That's what I'm saying. I need to freaking get some frequent flyer status here. And I don't think
I'm gonna start calling you Carbon Bigfoot.
I know. Seriously, I'm the reason the planet's warming right here. Actually, I know some people who put me to shame in the amount that they fly. But how are you going to get around? There's not another choice.
I don't know. That's the dilemma. That is the kind of, you know, question people need to wrangle. I mean, we got to do so many things that requires to be in so many places. Do we cut off travel completely? Do we reschedule our lives? Do we, you know, look at the way we live and decide that certain things are just out of bounds or only certain people can go? I mean, this just, it goes in so many directions.
Yeah, for my personal travel, like traveling to Montreal, I could decide to travel by train and just say I'm going to take a couple days to get there. Or I could decide I'm going to vacation locally. I'm not going to go far. I'm not going to spend that much energy and waste just to satisfy my curiosity. I could make those decisions. That's a whole different conversation than work. If work is sending you somewhere, well, then it's a question of, you know, the workplace itself has to determine, is this valuable? And a workplace generally isn't going to send you anywhere unless they think it's valuable to the bottom line.
I see it. Shall we get to some questions?
Sure. What do we got?
Let me see. Dun, dun, dun.
From Megalopolis?
Megalopolis.
Oh, I met Fez, actually. He's our first commenter. He was in Montreal. He came to a meetup.
Oh, nice.
And he reiterated what he wrote here on the blog, which is he is an urban planner, and he really liked our conversation about how cities work. And I said, well, you know, we're totally amateurs. I'm sure we got all kinds of things wrong. He's like, no, you know, the conclusions that you came to are pretty much the same conclusions that you hear lots of urban planners coming to.
Yes. And, you know, it's really, you know, there's so many interests involved as a city or urban planning, you know, comes into play. I mean, take, for example, the Central Valley Modesto, where I lived for 7 years. When they were putting in new tract housing, it was considered to be a boon to the city council because you could start getting all these new tax base, right? You have people paying into the local tax system. But, you know, there are a lot of opponents, many of them who were concerned that a lot of arable land, like that used to be orchards, were being basically paved over with cement and blacktop to make, you know, room for all these homes for people who were essentially commuting, adding to the, you know, the Central Valley has very bad air pollution to begin with because so much of the pollution from the Bay Area gets blown in from the West. And they said, well, you're just going to add to it. And there's all these kind of discussions. But ultimately, you know, the tract housing won out. And I don't know. It's just very sprawly. It just wasn't really, I don't think, what people wanted in the longer term. Because if you look at it, it's cheap to do, but you have this very kind of very thin layer of population over a very broad area of space. I don't think that's very conducive to a community sense or civic sensibility.
And then Derek Chen says, I'm not too sure how it is in Houston, but for Los Angeles, it's pretty important to differentiate Los Angeles City, Los Angeles County, and the Los Angeles metropolitan area. The mindset of those, especially in the city, are quite different than those who live out in the suburbs. Tom, you may be surprised at how LA City residents look at mass transit. Those who actually live in the city tend to be in favor of mass transit projects, including western extensions of the metro and development of dedicated bike lanes. LA City often clashes with the surrounding suburbs as the latter look to focus their budgets on freeways. In some ways, it's quite similar to New York, which has the city at odds with the rest of the state, fighting for budget for intra-city transit, like subways, bike lanes, and congestion pricing. Also, as gas prices continue to rise, people definitely are rethinking their use of the car. I think that's a good point that Derek brings up. There are, and I probably underplayed the amount of people in Los Angeles, not just city, but also county, who are in favor of mass transit. But I have heard from people who live in Los Angeles City, that opinion espoused that taking mass transit is looked on as a poor person's thing to do. I think it's a class thing. I think if you're middle class or above and live in LA City, you're probably more receptive to mass transit than if you're working class or below, in which case it's probably seen as something you want to escape from.
I still think it's a chicken and egg thing. I think if the transit system wasn't as underfunded as it was, you know, where it was just, you know, given just, you know, the modicum of funding, you know, maybe attitudes would be different. I don't know. I mean,
yeah, but to get the funding, you have to have the attitude to be different.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And it's a chicken egg thing. So I don't know. It's, you know, when you look at how BART came about in the Bay Area, it's a very interesting history. I mean, there are a lot of conflicting interests, not just the local municipalities, like who's going to pay for all this. Everyone liked the idea. It was just really just cost for a lot of them. But you also had things like Caltrains, who were worried that BART was going to take ridership away from them as they made extensions toward SFO, you know, because there's this plan to extend it all the way down to San Jose, if possible.
See that battle being fought in the Bay Area as they try to extend BART through San Jose and connect it to the other lines in the East Bay.
Yeah.
And there's lots of resistance to it. There's also a weird history of public transit in Marin County. They're putting in a train, but it keeps getting, you know, the budget keeps getting changed and the extent of the line keeps getting changed. And, you know, Marin County, you would think, wow, that, you know, that's one of the most liberal counties in the United States of America. They should be all for public transit. But it becomes different when it becomes local and you realize what impact it's going to have on the budget of your city and the services that you love. And then the reality of like, oh, wait, then people will be able to easily get into my neighborhood. And do I want that?
Well, that's basically, I mean, there's a bunch of conflicting interests. I think the last thing you mentioned is kind of typical. It's like, you know, what makes it easy for me to transit and go into the city or somewhere around the Bay Area allows someone from outside to come in. And for a lot of people who've paid millions of dollars for this, you know, kind of home castle, you know, that's far enough away from the riffraff that you don't have to deal with them, but it's close enough so you can still get to the city and do the business you have to. But, you know, typically most rail lines require a huge capital cost up front. I mean, you have to, it's millions, you know, tens of millions of dollars that you got to spend initially. And, you know, just coming up with that money, it's like, well, you know, now that you're looking at my wallet, it doesn't look so shiny anymore.
And yet, I was thinking about this a lot when we were in Montreal. In 1968, Montreal decided to put in the metro system. And it is very well done. It goes all over the central part of the city. It looks like, and I didn't experience this, it feeds out into the suburbs where there's other train systems that it hooks up with. And it was very easy. It was as good as New York as far as getting around in Montreal. And I was shocked because my theory has always been, well, the cities that put it in before cars are the ones that have the extensive, well-run systems, with few exceptions. But Washington, D.C. is an exception. And now I've got Montreal as another exception where it's like, you know what? No, maybe it was the Olympics or the Expo that motivated them to want to do it. But whatever it was, you know, in 1968... You know, same time that BART was being put in San Francisco, they made it happen, and it's much more extensive and much more usable than BART.
Yeah, well, BART's regional. It wasn't designed to be a municipal transit system, although I use it that way because it has like seven stops in the city, six or seven stops. But it's you know, it's very telling, you know. It's much easier to kind of to spend that money when you have a big event that's going to bring in lots of outside dollars. I always wondered why LA never – see, I'm trying to figure out where the genesis of the LA subway system started. Was it before LA Olympics.
It came after the LA Olympics were in 84.
Yeah.
I don't think the metro system came along until later in the decade. But I think what Derek is saying is they're in LA City, we shouldn't discount the fact that there are a large number of people who want public transit, and they're the ones who have pushed for this line to actually exist. So, well, good to be back in the East meets West saddle again, Roger.
Yeah, except you'll be out next week, right?
I'll be out next week, but I'll be back on Monday.
So okay.
We could conceivably do the show on Monday, or so. We could definitely do a show next week. I'll just be gone Friday through Sunday.
Well, Monday is Memorial Day, so
maybe Tuesday, but we could do a later show. That's fine.
Yeah, that's cool.
All right. Well, thanks everybody for listening and watching. You can find us on the web at subbrilliant.com/EMW. Leave us a note as Fez and Derek and Brian and Francis and Folk and Thunderful, Darren and Mag Tim Mag all did last week. Thanks everybody for listening. We'll talk to you next time.
Bye.
About this and other shows, visit frogpants.com. Audio program so good, it's like you're there.